Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the fall of 2004, Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Farnaz Fasihi sent an email to friends about the realities of reporting in Iraq. It wasn't intended for the world to read, but that's exactly what happened. In the email, Farnaz wrote, quote, "The genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed onto this country as a result of American mistakes, and it can't be put back into a bottle." Farnaz Fasihi first went to Iraq in October of 2002 as a reporter for the Newark Star-Ledger. In 2003, after being hired by the Wall Street Journal, she was again dispatched to Iraq to cover the impending invasion. She stayed there until late 2005. In Iraq, she witnessed and documented the unraveling of normal life for Iraqis, and she writes about the people she met and the struggles they face in her new book, Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. On today's Your Call, we'll talk to Farnaz about the people she met. We'll also talk about how the Iraqi experience should figure into the American debate. How do the claims we're hearing from John McCain and Barack Obama match up with the real lives of Iraqis? Farnaz Fasihi is Deputy Bureau Chief of the Middle East and Africa for the Wall Street Journal. She's based in Beirut, but she's currently here in the U.S. for her book tour, and she joins me here in studio. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Now, you left Iraq in late 2005, but your partner, who writes for Newsweek, just left Iraq a month ago. So you're still very connected to Iraq.
Yes, I've stayed connected with Iraq through Babak, my partner, being there, and also, writing the book, which involved being in constant communication with our staff there and some of my Iraqi friends.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates made a surprise visit to Iraq today, and there was a car bombing in Baghdad that killed 12 people and 36 were wounded. So what has really changed since you left?
I think what's changed is that violence is dramatically decreased. I think you can say that things have improved in terms of violence and car bombs. But I think the car bomb today is a good reminder that things are still not normal in Baghdad. When we say that Iraq is stabilized, we're comparing it to the height of the civil war in 2006, but we're not comparing it to a normal functioning society where the citizens feel safe and secure to go about their day. You know, every day there's some sort of a car bomb, assassination, landmine. There's some sort of a violence attack every single day in Iraq.
You write about a number of the people that you met, and we should also mention that you were born here in the U.S.
I was.
But you are of Iranian descent.
Yes.
How does that shape the way you see this conflict?
I think that my Iranian background was very helpful and handy. It gave me an understanding of the Middle East, of the culture, the religion. I also lived in Iran until I was 10. Although I was born here, I went back as a child. So I had witnessed, I had childhood memories of the Iran-Iraq war, and I have relatives who still live in Iran. So for me, it was I felt it much more intimately than perhaps other correspondents.
And do you think that it was easier for you to get access?
I think it was. I think that Iraqis felt comfortable with me because they thought that I'm from, you know, a country next door, and I had experienced some of the hardships that they've suffered, or at least I had relatives who'd gone through that. I also think being a woman in the Muslim world is an asset because it allows you access to the women in the family, and you get invited into homes, which was very useful as a reporter.
Now, before we talk about some specific stories, the Project for Excellence in Journalism found that Iraq is receiving still just about 3% of the headlines in American media. So why is this happening? Why should we care about Iraq? And do you think that the American public does want to hear more about Iraq?
I would like to think that the American public wants to hear about Iraq and should want to hear about Iraq. That's a good question. Why should we care? We should care because you know, our country went to war, and in, by and large, it's still at war in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's necessary and crucial to really examine the facts after the war and sort of have it be part of the public discourse in this country. That what did we achieve? What's really going on? Because if we just hang on to ideology and the things that we would we'd like to think happened, then it sets a dangerous precedent. You know, you could repeat the same mistakes. So I think that Americans should care and should pay attention to what's happening there.
Are you surprised there's so little reporting?
I'm very surprised. I think part of that, maybe it's because of elections. Part of that is that, you know, all the news just comes out sounding the same, car bombs, violence, and people just all lump it all together. But it's much more nuanced and layered than that. And you know, in the past year, there's this concept, there's this perception that Iraq is stable and we've succeeded, and so why should we care? But that's not the case. It's very fragile. It could fall apart easily, and we should care.
Now, your partner just left Iraq a month ago. What are the realities today of reporting in Iraq? And is it possible to leave the comfort of the green zone and actually talk to real people on the street?
It is possible. Iraq, while it can't be compared to any other foreign posting, you know, and like any other country that you just get in your car and go to places, there's a lot of security still involved. You can leave the green zone. You can go to certain neighborhoods, not all neighborhoods, and stay for maybe half an hour to interview people and go into shops, but you still have to travel in a convoy. You have to have armed guards with you. You know, it's gotten better, but it's, again, as I say, it's not like a normal foreign correspondent posting.
And what about the daily life in terms of infrastructure? Is there clean water, electricity?
Daily life still has not resumed back to its pre-war days. I think electricity is officially 5 or 6 hours a day in Baghdad still. This is 6 years after the war. Clean water is a problem. Sewage is a problem. Just regular infrastructure has not been up to speed.
So talk about some of the people that you focus on in your book. One of the families is the Nasser family. You met them before the invasion in 2002.
Right. The Nasser family were a middle-class, educated Christian Iraqi family that I met in 2002. And while they were against the war, but they were hopeful that maybe the American invasion would bring about some prosperity to Iraq. It would open up some opportunities for them. But that didn't happen. You know, slowly security fell apart. There were no work opportunities. Their businesses went bankrupt. The children of the Nasser family, the two elder sons, are now, the older one is now a refugee in Amman, living in very bad conditions. And the Nassers themselves were forced to leave their neighborhoods because of the segregation, you know, sort of sectarian segregation after the civil war. So they had to abandon their home and move to a Christian area, and they still haven't returned. They're also suffering financial hardship. They've sold all their antiques and their jewelry and a lot of their furniture just to survive.
And are you still in contact with them?
I am. I spoke to them actually last week, yes.
How are they doing?
They're doing okay. You know, it's not easy. They're they just don't know what's going to happen, you know, and the fact that they're still living as internal refugees, they're living with relatives, hoping, you know, to return home one day, back to their old house. It's hard.
And it's very rare to hear from Iraqis in this country. Mm-hmm. And based on the conversations you've had with people, what are they saying? I mean, what do they want to see happen now?
Iraqis in Iraq?
Right.
I think Iraqis in Iraq would like to see security return. They'd like to see, you know, there's always been this a conflict when you ask Iraqis about what they think about the Americans. They want the Americans to leave, but at the same time, they don't want them to leave too soon because they don't want the country to fall back into the Sunni-Shia civil war of the 2006. But I think that, you know, security is has been the number one concern of all Iraqis.
And do they feel like the U.S. owes them something? I mean, I think about the rebuilding and all of the billions of dollars that have been wasted, the infrastructure that is still crumbled. I mean, do they talk about those
Absolutely.
Issues?
I think that you hear Iraqis saying all the time that we didn't ask the U.S. to come in. We didn't. They invaded our country. They declared war on us. So they have a responsibility to see this through, to bring security, to make sure that our armed forces are capable of running the country and our government is actually functioning. So they definitely look to the Americans as their protectors in some way.
So what does this mean in terms of leaving the country?
Well, that's the thing. You know, they don't want they're very nervous about a significant withdrawal of American troops, because they think that if that happens too soon, or if it happens under the wrong circumstances, you could have the militia springing up again and fighting resuming. But again, as I said, they're also very uncomfortable with the idea of a foreign force presence. So I think the best that the U.S. can do is just to make sure that both the government and the Iraqi military is functional before it leaves.
Last week, General David Petraeus was interviewed on the BBC, and he said that recent security gains were, quote, not irreversible, and that the U.S. still faced a, quote, long struggle.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of these terms that you hear from the military?
I think that they're trying to be pragmatic. I think they're trying to also say, Iraq is not a done deal. You know, it's not the deals they have made with the Sunnis insurgents, where they're on the payroll, and the ceasefire with the Shia militia could easily snap and fighting could resume. I think that, the military is hoping for the best, but it's not guaranteed because they're not, the solutions they have are not sustainable long term. You can't keep Sunnis on the American payroll forever, and you can't expect Muqtada to have a ceasefire without making any political gains.
Well, and see, this is what's interesting. All of these players are mm-hmm. often missing from the debate in this country when
right.
politicians claim that the violence is down.
Right.
So what do we need to know really about the reasons for the violence going down?
I think the reasons for the violence going down is as much internal as it is external. I think that we need to know that it's also very fragile. Any one of these three things, the three things that have made violence go down are the surge of the American troops combined with putting Sunni insurgents on American payroll and promising to integrate them into the Iraqi forces, and also Muqtada Sadr's militia being dissolved in ceasefire. Now, any one of those things could, taken out of the equation, could unravel the whole deal. I think that's the most important thing to understand.
And do you think that that's possible?
Absolutely. Of course it's possible. You know, there are so many dynamics. One of the other things to remember is that Iraq is not an isolated case in the Middle East anymore. What happens in Iraq, has effects outside its borders, in Iran, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Saudi Arabia. So I think also the regional players here are very important.
And then neighborhoods have been ethnically cleansed, and then there are literally walls surrounding the different neighborhoods. So it's incredibly difficult to get from point A to point B.
Right. I think one of the things that Americans don't realize is how visually absurd Baghdad looks. Mm-hmm. You know, you have 12 feet, 16 foot cement barriers surrounding neighborhoods. Imagine like if you take a chunk of, Manhattan, Midtown Manhattan, and put a wall around it, or, you know, put a wall around Harlem and put a wall around East Village, and then issue security residential cards for people who live there and set up checkpoints for them to come in and out. This is what Baghdad looks like. And this is why violence is down, because they've taken extreme measures. But these extreme measures are not sustainable in the long term.
And then there's also the refugee problem,
right?
Which we'll speak more about after the break.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 5 million?
It's approximately 5 million. It's about 2.5 million internal, 2.5 million outside.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Farnaz Fasihi. She is the Deputy Bureau Chief of the Middle East and Africa for the Wall Street Journal. She was in Iraq from 2003 to 2005, and she writes about her experience in a new book called Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. She tells the stories of several Iraqis that she met while in Iraq, and she's still very connected to Iraq. Her partner just left Iraq a month ago. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question for Farnaz about what's happening on the ground, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Also, how do the claims we're hearing from John McCain and Barack Obama match up to the real lives of Iraqis? What do you think about that debate? 866-798-8255. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Listen to Your Call on KALW, your local public radio station here in San Francisco. The time is 20 minutes after 11 o'clock. Coming up at noon, it's news and notes, followed by alternative radio at 1 o'clock today. Tom Hayden on movements and Machiavellians, Obama versus McCain. That's alternative radio today at 1 o'clock, followed by the state we're in at 2 o'clock. From the Canadian, or rather from Radio Netherlands with Jonathan Gruber, a special focus on human rights issues. The State We're In at 2 o'clock on KELW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation about voter suppression, and we'll be joined by Steven Rosenfeld, author of Count My Vote, and Dorothy Fadiman, producer of Stealing America, Vote by Vote. Last week, we talked about electronic voting machines, and then tomorrow, we're going to talk about voter suppression, find out what are some of the most pressing issues in the swing states, and then also what can we do here in California to ensure that all eligible voters actually cast their votes. And then on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with Paul Ehrlich, Stanford biologist and author of The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. Human beings have now established their dominion over the planet. The question is, can we stop ourselves from destroying it? That's on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, we'll be speaking with Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz about his book, The $3 Trillion War. We'll also be talking about the economy. And if you have a show idea for us or an overall comment, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. But today we are speaking with Farnaz Fasihi. She is Deputy Bureau Chief of the Middle East and Africa for the Wall Street Journal. She's out with a new book about the time she spent in Iraq from 2003 to 2005 called Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about Iraq, do you care about Iraq? Do you follow Iraq on a regular basis? If so, where do you get your information? And then also, we're going to talk a little later in the show about the political debate, I guess we're sort of having in this country, and talk about John McCain and Barack Obama. Do you think that the claims we're hearing from them really match up with the real lives of Iraqis? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you have a question about the reality on the ground, if you hear something in the media and you're not sure about it, give us a call and we'll ask Farnaz. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. So we don't hear about the refugee crisis and the internally displaced crisis on a regular basis. Can you give us an update? What is currently happening?
Currently, there are approximately 5 million Iraqis who have been displaced since the war. There are about 2.5 million inside of Iraq and 2.5 million in neighboring countries, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. They live a life of limbo outside of the country because they're not allowed to work or they're not allowed to send their kids to school. They really don't have a legal status in the other countries, and the best that they can hope for is that they could get resettled by the UNHCR to a host country. I think one of the reasons that we don't hear much about them is because of the cultural traditions in the Middle East. The internally displaced live with relatives or extended relatives, or they're all cramped up in one room. You don't see the dramatic pictures we see out of Darfur or Africa, where they're in tents and they're starving and they're out in the cold for it to make an impact. But 5 million is a very big number.
And what about are there resources? We've done shows about mm-hmm. Iraqi refugees and have spoken to a number of organizations that just talk about the difficulties in finding resources for Iraqis, whether it's for basics. I mean, you've got educated people who were doctors, lawyers, engineers who are now in Syria and Jordan working, you know, as janitors or trying to get construction work.
I mean, that's what happens. It's the story of war. You know, they've been displaced. They were somebody in their country, but now when they don't have work permit, they don't have a legal status, they can't really set roots in these countries. So, I mean, we talked about the Nassers. Their elder son and daughter-in-law are now in Amman. They're both engineers, but they're working as lowly secretaries for Iraqi firms and getting paid a combined monthly salary of $300, which for a family of four is really very, very little. So, you know, the adults are skipping meals. They're not taking taxis if they don't have to. They're not buying anything. It's a very difficult existence.
Let's hear from our first caller. Let's go to Michael in Vallejo. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I have a few things that I'd like you to comment on. First of all is the McCain-Palin repeated statement that victory is at hand, and claiming that Obama and the Democrats want to quit just when victory is at hand. Do you see a victory at hand? And then, if you wouldn't mind, also, the other very disturbing thing is that none of our politicians or journalists mainstream ever mention the number of Iraqis killed. Mm-hmm. It's always 4,000 American troops, and I understand, I've heard the number 1.2 million Iraqis. And I just want you to address that as well as civilian casualties.
All right, thank you, Michael. So first question, what do you think about that comment, quote, victory is at hand?
I think we're very far from victory in Iraq, and I think it depends on how you define victory. Why did we go into Iraq? Did we go, right now the victory that we're talking about is being able to reduce violence from 1,000 people getting killed in Baghdad to maybe 100. If the U.S. went into Iraq to bring about a democratic government, to stabilize the Middle East, to bring prosperity to Iraq, then we're very far from that goal. The numbers and the facts speak for themselves. There are 5 million people who are refugees. If victory was at hand, I think that educated and middle-class Iraqis would not be fleeing Iraq. When you speak to Iraqis, what they say is that it's going to be at least 20, 30 years before Iraq becomes a kind of society where they would feel comfortable raising their children, where they would feel comfortable leaving for work in the morning. We saw today in the headlines that there was a car bomb. This is the kind of threat that they live with every day. Maybe instead of 10 car bombs, there's one car bomb. But can you imagine if you had one car bomb in San Francisco a day? The second question about number of Iraqi casualties, there has been no proper documentation of Iraqi civilian casualties. The American military says that it doesn't document Iraqi civilian casualties, and aid organizations have long left Iraq, at least they're like such as the UN and the Red Cross, after the attacks against their organizations. Their foreign staff now operate out of Amman. Most of the numbers that we have are cobbled together from media reports, and they vary somewhere from 100,000 to 1 million civilian deaths.
And again, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates made a surprise visit to Iraq today, and there was a car bombing in Baghdad. At least 12 people died, 36 people were wounded. And according to Iraq body count, 129 Iraqis died just last week.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for calling in, Michael. And if you have a question for Farnaz Fasihi, she is Deputy Bureau Chief of the Middle East for the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking to Farnaz today about her new book, Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'll also ask Farnaz later in the show what she thinks about John McCain and Barack Obama's comments about Iraq, and just really how that matches up or doesn't match up at all with the real lives of Iraqis. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Thank you again, Michael. Let's hear from Dahlia, who's calling in from Denver. Hi, Dahlia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you, Ms. Fasihi, for your extensive work covering Iraq. I would just, depending on what Iraqis you talk to, you might get a different story. But I would strongly disagree with the sentiment that most Iraqis are saying Americans should eventually withdraw but stay until the government and the army are stable. The government is perceived as a puppet government. It is controlled by the American CIA in the green zone. And so the majority of Iraqis I'm in touch with are advocating and demanding immediate, unconditional withdrawal, the end to the illegal occupation. My question is with regards to there's been repeated reference to sectarian strife and civil war. If Ms. Fasihi has any information related to some of the work that journalist Max Fuller has done on the American-funded and trained death squads in Iraq that are basically putting into a place a divide-and-conquer strategy, organizing and effecting ethnic cleansing.
All right, and stay on the line, Dahlia.
Sure.
Go ahead.
You know, I think as you put it, Dahlia, depending on what Iraqis you speak with, that you get different responses about the question of the presence of American troops. As I mentioned to you, part of their national pride, part of longing is to see an end to a foreign military presence in Iraq, namely American. Nobody likes to see a foreign military convoy holding guns, marching down the streets, or military checkpoints by Americans. But at the same time, Iraqis who live in Iraq are very apprehensive because they did go through that cycle of violence with the Sunni militia and the Shia militia. And they're worried that if the Americans leave, maybe that would happen again. Maybe the government's not strong enough. As you mentioned, there are internal security squads within the Iraqi Interior Ministry, who were Shia, who were, of course, the Iraqi security forces are trained by the Americans. That's part of the agreements that they have with the Iraqi army to train their security forces. When in 2006 you saw a lot of these squads going in and taking revenge against Sunni civilians because of the cycle of violence. This is part of the people taking laws into their own hands. And, confronted, the Iraqi government said that they were acting independently. But
Dahlia, are you still with us?
Yes.
And this is Dahlia Wasfi, right?
Yes.
Hi, Dahlia. Yeah, you've been on our show before. And just to let people know, you're an Iraqi-American activist who's spoken out against the occupation of a war. You also against the occupation of Iraq. You also spoke at Winter Soldier. And since we have you on the line, what is your assessment of the debate that this country is or is not having? I mean, what do you make of what John McCain and Barack Obama are both saying about Iraq?
Thank you for the opportunity. It's very, very discouraging. This is the same thing that happened in 2004, except the situation is considerably worse, that people are just, Americans are not paying attention to what's going on, that our focus is on basically two corporate candidates, neither of which has a sense of the devastation and incredible suffering that we have brought to the Iraqi people and the Afghan people, as Barack Obama talks about going back to fight the good war, that the bottom line is 90% of the casualties are civilian, that we are continuing to bring death and destruction in the name of corporate profit. So that's the reality. And I think neither McCain nor Obama, unfortunately, is going to end the occupations. Rather, there might be redeployment of troops, but any drawdown in numbers is likely to be replaced by mercenaries who, of course, are laughing all the way to the bank, corporations like Blackwater and DynCorp and Khaki, on and on. So, unfortunately, I just hope November rolls around as fast as it possibly can so we can get back to focusing on the issues.
And Dahlia, do you still have family in Iraq?
I do, and I was there. I haven't been there since the spring of 2006. And I should have said that in the beginning. I didn't mean to blindside the guests. But at the time, it was quite evident. Usually the Western press marks the bombing of the shrine in Samarra as a start of the quote-unquote sectarian strife. And at the time, the reports, the local media was saying that Sunni and Shia imams were coming together and praying together, saying this is not us. That clearly that these were, first of all, the shrine was an Iraqi treasure. It is an Islamic treasure, and this is most likely external forces who did such a sophisticated demolition of the shrine. And for 30 years, Saddam Hussein, who we know is a Sunni, was in power, and nothing happened to that shrine. When we put the leaders of Iraq that we wanted to capture, the American military did, on a deck of cards, 35 of 55 were Shia. So pretty much if you towed the party line, you got along fine in Iraq and with the Ba'ath Party. It had nothing to do with religious differences. And so what's happening in Iraq today is a result of external influences.
Well, Dahlia, thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me contribute. Many thanks for your program.
Thank you. That's Dalia Wasfi, an Iraqi-American activist. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question for today's guest, Farnaz Fasihi, Deputy Bureau Chief of the Middle East and Africa for the Wall Street Journal, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have a question about what you're hearing in the debate about Iraq, specifically comments you're hearing from John McCain and Barack Obama, give us a call. Also, just more generally about the realities that the Iraqis face on the ground on a regular basis. Farnaz left Iraq a couple of years ago, but her partner just left 1 month ago, so she's still very connected to Iraq. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And Farnaz, Dalia brought up the corporations that are making just a lot of money because of the occupation. And what's also, McCain and Obama both are talking about Iraq, really, the government needs to govern itself and safeguard its people. Now, the Wall Street Journal, just a couple of days ago, I think it was actually last month, they have an article called Iraq Seeks F-16 Fighters. Mm-hmm. Iraq is becoming the number one buyer of weapons in the world. The U.S. just approved the sale of 24 American attack helicopters to Iraq, valued at $2.4 billion. Overall, Iraq plans to purchase at least $10 billion in U.S. tanks and armored vehicles, transport planes, other battlefields from companies like Boeing and Raytheon. What do you make of this compared to the infrastructure on the ground?
It's very disappointing. I mean, as Dalia pointed out, there's no question that there are corporations benefiting from the Iraq war, namely security, say it like Blackwater security firms that have security personnel in Iraq. And also, you know, the Defense Department, I guess, by selling arms to Iraq. For the average Iraqi, it's very difficult to comprehend that a security personnel is getting paid $1,000 a day, which is the going rate, and that they still have five hours of electricity after five years, or that they still don't have jobs, or they don't have security.
And then
it builds a lot of resentment.
Well, and also, what are people saying to you, the Iraqis, about the sectarian violence in Iraq? How do they explain that?
What do you mean? Like, about what led to it?
Right, and why it's happening.
Well, you know, you had, under Saddam Hussein, you had mostly a predominantly Sunni government, and Sunnis were ruling and Shias were kind of suppressed and oppressed. And that reversed the order when the Americans came to power. Part of the de-Ba'athification process that marginalized the Sunnis and gave rise to the Shias reversed the order. So that started a little bit of a resentment, but I think it was the ongoing Sunni insurgency. It was the fact that Shias were constantly targeted at funerals and schools and police training and gatherings. After a while, the Shia started attacking. For a year, they listened to the clerics saying, wait, just vote. Once we're in power, once you have a Shia government, we'll protect you. And that didn't happen. So by 2006, you saw complete anarchy, people just taking law into their own hands. You would see the cycle of violence, as I mentioned in the book, where you had, in a neighborhood that there were just ordinary people, a car bomb would go off, targeting Shias, and they would all get killed. The next night, Shia squads from the military, from the internal security, would go and arrest all the Sunni men. So you had this revenge thing going on all the time, and sectarian killings.
You also write about your drivers.
Mm-hmm.
Haki?
Haki was my translator and Manaf my driver. Yes, right. The team that I traveled all over Iraq with.
Tell us about them.
Haki and Manaf were two Sunni men, in their early 20s when I met them. I met them about a week after I got to Baghdad in April 2003 and hired them because Haki spoke very good English and they were just very resourceful. And, we traveled all over Iraq together and they were instrumental in my work there. And just watching what happened to their lives was also very eye-opening, particularly when it was difficult for us to be able to go out and see how Iraqis were faring just through their stories of what was happening. And, you know, Haki left in 2006 and didn't return, and he's here. He lives in Detroit as a refugee. And Manaf is still there. He's now our office manager. And he was forced to leave his home with his family in the middle of the night. They were Sunni, after Shia neighbors warned them that they may get killed if they stay. Mm. So they had to evacuate and move to a different neighborhood, which was all Sunni.
And you asked them also, quote, would you join the resistance?
Mm-hmm.
And how did they respond to that?
They told me this was early in 2003, late 2003, when the resistance was forming. It was interesting to see that they viewed the insurgent attacks against the American soldiers as justified, because they felt like this was a declared occupation, the year 2003. And as citizens of this country, they felt that they had the right to resist the occupation. So they saw that as justified, but they didn't see the attacks against the civilians justified. And they were, you know, normal young Iraqis who didn't hate freedom. They didn't hate democracy. They didn't hate pop culture. They actually liked, they watched shows like Friends and wanted to learn American slang. And, you know, they wanted to have pretty girlfriends and drive nice cars. So, you know, they were just like any other 24-year-old in America. So for me, it was very eye-opening to see that even people like them could not be won over by the ideological things the U.S. was saying then.
And that did you hear that from a lot of young Iraqis?
I did. I heard that from a lot of particularly Sunni young Iraqis, yes.
What about the Sunni and the Shia that you worked with? Were there any conflicts with them?
There was a lot of conflicts by the year 2000 and by 2005 when the civil tension started taking form. You know, there were a lot of problems. Our Sunni staff would not go reporting into the Shia areas. We had a Shia cook who all the Sunni staff were suspicious of. Mm. You know, there was tension between the guards. So, you know, definitely the tensions and the problems outside were seeping into our bureau.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking today with Farnaz Fasihi. She's the Deputy Bureau Chief of the Middle East and Africa for the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking to her about her new book, Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. Farnaz reported from Iraq from 2002 to 2005. Her partner just left Iraq a month ago, so she still has very close connections to Iraq. And if you have a question for Farnaz about the realities on the ground, give us a call. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Also, what do you think, what are the realities of Iraq and its futures that John McCain is possibly ignoring and Obama is refusing to address? And do you think that the Iraqi experience is figuring at all into the debate that we're having in this country? 866-798-8255. And then we started off the show talking about why we should care about Iraq. Do you care? Do you follow Iraq? And, you know, where do you get your news from Iraq? And why do you think that we're still not hearing much information about it? And do you think that it'll become more of an issue in the next, well, it's just over about a month and a half now until the election? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. And let's hear from John calling in from San Jose. Good morning, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. My question is, I'm going to bring up the issue of the Iraqi refugees again. Mm-hmm. And is there any form of organizations to get aid to them, especially in Syria? It's just a terrible situation there. I was there over New Year, and we took some aid in. Mm. But we had to do it sub rosa. I mean, the Syrian government doesn't want to give them aid because then they're afraid they'll stay. And the United Nations, from what help I saw, is they were just so disorganized, and they were helping a minimum number of families, like 500 families out of 2 million people there, you know. And is there any kind of a formal effort being done? Are people trying to coordinate anything for that?
And John, please stay on the line. Farnaz?
Hi, John. That's a very good question. As far as I know, there are some aid agencies, local NGOs, and international NGOs who work typically with refugees, like the International Organization for Migration and the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees, who are very closely involved with the Iraqi refugee crisis in Syria and in Jordan and Lebanon. In terms of whether there are organizations who help them in terms of schooling and giving them money or helping them get started, they're local NGOs. You know, in Lebanon, I know they're local Lebanese NGOs who work with them, but they have very, you know, their funds are limited. There's only so much they can do because the refugees don't have legal status, so they can't really get jobs. As you say, the governments don't want them to stay. The Middle East already saw the same thing with the Palestinians who were who had to, you know, after the Six-Day War with Israel, some three decades ago, left, and they've been in limbo for three decades. So they don't want to see a repeat of that. But they're, unfortunately, the Western countries don't have enough slots. I mean, the United States is only taking in 17,000 Iraqi refugees. That's a very small number compared to 2.5 million people who are refugees, you know, 17,000 to 2.5 million.
And I actually have not heard either Obama or McCain talk about Iraqi refugees.
I haven't heard that either. I think they have a response. I mean, I think the U.S. has a responsibility. It invaded Iraq, and now there are 5 million refugees. So,
and John, you said you were in Syria over New Year's?
Yes.
And what was your experience like? What did you hear from Iraqis?
Well, it was terrible. Like she says, it's not the same as the Darfur people, but I was I kind of acted as a chaperone for a group of about 15 young people mm-hmm. who went. We went, we flew into Amman and then on to Damascus. Ostensibly, you know, we went in, and I won't say what our official reason for being there was, but we had to go in. We still did some of the cultural activities and things, but we spent time delivering clothing that had been donated for children. We specifically targeted taking winter clothing for children, and I was able to take like about two duffel bags full of children's mittens and hats and everything there. And we went out, and the children took them. We had contacts on the ground. One of the other gentlemen with us is local, and we actually ended up giving assistance to some schools that have been set up trying to improve the English. Like they are the main reason that Syria says they can't go to school is they don't know enough English, because in Iraq they didn't learn English till fifth grade, and it's first grade in Syria.
And what did you hear from the Iraqis? Did they ask you to send the Americans any messages or?
Excuse me a minute. It just keeps bringing it back. The message is, you know, why us? You know, it's like, and they agree with other people that are called in, that they at least one quarter to one third of these refugees were mixed marriage families mm-hmm. that had to leave. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was a history of not having that problem until that mosque was blown up. And that's what makes a lot of people really, and they're all of the instance that it was instigated, that the divide and conquer rule of the Western powers got that started. In other words, they can't see either Shia or Sunni in Iraq doing that kind of discussion on a mosque, because they knew that there'd be utter retaliation one way or the other. The other thing is we had a meeting with a group of women, and these are a group that have banded together of women who are widows, and or women who have all been in, you know, or their husbands have been disappeared into the Abu Ghraib prison system, been arrested, and they've had to flee. I have in my possession several affidavits from women who were arrested and are kicking the door in the middle of the night scenarios. I mean, it brings tears to your eyes when you look at, on the ground, face-to-face with the effects of American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. A total illegal operation, illegal occupation. And you see the results of that. Like, she pointed out, it's a result of war. It's in it, you know, and America is taking absolutely no responsibility for those refugees. The only people that we're bringing in as refugees are people who worked with us in the Green Zone, period.
This is true, John. I think the priority is given to people who worked. Iraqis who worked for the Americans in any capacity are given priority. And I think that's one of the things that's, on one hand, you know, they should, because they risked their lives and serviced Americans. On the other, there's so many other compelling stories and people who are suffering.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, John. And we actually have an article at yourcallradio.org written by Iraqi women's organizations about the reality that women face in Iraq, specifically the widows. So thank you for calling in, John. Let's hear from Nikki in Templeton. Hi, Nikki. Thank you for holding.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Mine is sort of a question and a comment. I recently heard an interview of a journalist who I believe is either a Wall Street Journal political writer. I can't remember his name. I'm sorry. But it was about he's been following McCain's whole life and career. And he wrote about, and I actually had kind of an epiphany moment. I'm certainly not even remotely a McCain supporter. But I had this experience when I heard this man who dedicated his journalistic life to writing about McCain talk about how his experience in Vietnam has so completely influenced and clouded his ability to look at any other war situation objectively. And I wondered if, you know, when I heard that and I heard some of when he came home and what had happened, you know, what was going on before he left and then what was happening when he returned, and the change in the political atmosphere of the whole country, and how much that impacted him. And, you know, I mean, I don't have to tell you that this whole talk about winning the war is so infuriating and absurd to me. Mm. But when I heard this, it really affected me in thinking about, you know, it's impossible, I think, for this man to look at any war, and particularly this war, without having it totally tainted by his own personal experience in Vietnam.
Farnaz, would you like to comment on that?
The only comment I have is that it's, as you point out, important to examine each event, each war, through the facts surrounding it. While history is important, it's important to examine history and learn from it, but you can't carry the facts from the past and apply them to the present, because each situation is unique and it has its own set of realities. I think one of the things that that Americans forget is that why did we go to war? That the reasons that the Bush administration gave for invading Iraq were that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that it had links to al-Qaeda on September 11. Both of those reasons were proved false by independent studies in Washington. So that seems to be completely forgotten in the conversation about the war, that the reasons we went to war were false.
Well, how do you feel as a reporter who spent time in Iraq, right?
Right.
And Sarah Palin sent her son to Iraq on 9/11 and said he's going to fight the people who hit us on 9/11.
I mean, that's factually wrong. I think that you can, you know, when you send your sons to war, when you send your daughters to war, I think that you need to cling desperately to this idea that their lives are not going to be lost in vain, that they're fighting for a cause. But this is also dangerous, because if you don't really face the truth, then you could repeat the same mistake, or you could stumble, as the Americans have in Iraq, from one ideology to the next. Instead of really making pragmatic decisions, you end up making ideological decisions. Which is what happened the first year of the occupation. It was all ideology and had no resemblance to what we were seeing on the ground. It was just misinformation.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Nikki. Let's hear from Mohammed in San Francisco. Good morning, Mohammed.
Good morning. I had a couple of questions and a comment to make. The first question I would like to ask Farhanaz is what her heritage is, because I missed the first part of the interview. So that would be the first question. What is her heritage? The second question would be, You often hear the tensions between the Shias and the Sunnis and the Kurds in Iraq. And I kind of find a logical fallacy in there, or a historical fallacy, that the Shias and the Sunnis is like a religious faction, whereas the Kurds, that is an ethnicity rather than being a religious faction. And within the Kurds, there are Shias and Sunnis. Predominantly, there are Sunnis and a small number of Shias within them. So I don't get the idea of splitting them or giving them their own little segment in Iraqi society. So I would like to hear her comments on that. And the third question I had, the role of Iran that is being played in Iraq, because I myself, I'm from Pakistan, and we had this horrible problem in the early 90s. The clashes between Shias and Sunnis, and in Pakistan, Shias make around 12% of the population.
Okay, Mohammed, sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time, and I want to make sure Farnaz can answer your questions.
Mohammed, I'm ethnically Iranian. I'm Iranian-American. I was born in the U.S. to Iranian parents. Your second question about the Sunni Shia Kurds. I think the reason that you hear that division is because of the way politics and tensions have played out in Iraq. I think that if you look at the conflict within Iraq, it's three ways. The Kurds foremost identified themselves as Kurds before they identified themselves as Iraqis or Sunnis or Shias, and they stick together based on the fact of their ethnicity. The Arab Iraqis, the tensions really fall on the sectarian line of Sunni and Shia, and because violence has sort of been divided, politics was even divided along those lines. That's why you hear the media talking about that. What was
any comments about Iran?
Yes, Iran definitely has a lot of influence in Iraq. It from the very early days after the invasion, it was in there. It was working through clerics of networks of clerics and Shia political parties, and it has gained a lot of influence in Iraq. You can hear. I mean, I address that issue in my book thoroughly.
And then just last question, and we have about 15 seconds. Because you wrote about people, how should the Iraqi experience figure into the American debate? Do you think it will at all?
I hope that it will, because it's the human stories that are universal. And if the Americans are sick and tired of hearing about car bombs and about the policy, they can relate to the human story of the war. And I think it's important for them to hear. I think they owe it to the Iraqi people to hear what they've been through.
Farnaz Fasihi, thank you so much for joining us. Farnaz Fasihi, her book is called Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. She'll be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for listening. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. Will the enforcement or violation of voting rights decide a narrow election in November? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about voter suppression. We'll be joined by Stephen Rosenfeld, author of Count My Vote, and Dorothy Fadiman, producer of Stealing America, Vote by Vote. What are the most pressing issues in the swing states that we should know about? What can we do to ensure that all eligible voters actually cast their votes? And who's really looking out for them? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find a link to the Your Call podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
In the next The State We're In, we investigate the right to a toilet. Did you know that an estimated 2.6 billion people have no access at all to a toilet? This resident of Mumbai knows.
If you don't have a toilet, what do you do except go in the open, wherever you can? That's why you see that line of backsides as you come down from the airport into Bombay in the early morning.
The right to a toilet in the next edition of The State We're In.
The State We're In, 2 o'clock this afternoon on KALW San Francisco, your local public radio station at 91.7. Coming up next, it's news and notes. And then at 1 o'clock, it's alternative radio, movements and Machiavellians, Obama versus McCain with Tom.